The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, we all know who our next speaker is, so I won't go through the same introduction that I gave yesterday, but we're very delighted to have Dr. Oz Guinness with us, and delighted again, doubly so, to have him speaking again this afternoon. A couple of days ago, I received an email from Dr. Guinness. He was originally slated by ACCS, asked if he would give a talk for us today on the case for civility. Lord knows we have a great need of civility in our country today, probably throughout the world. However, he said he asked me if it was possible, if he could change his topic to Can Freedom Last Forever? The Founders' Forgotten Question and How We Are Doing Today. And he further stated, it has been more on my heart recently and has a far greater connection to the classics. So I wondered if it might not be better. And I said, yes, we'd be delighted to hear what's on his heart today. And so if you'd please welcome Dr. Guinness back up here, we'll listen to what he's on his heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patch. We have a saying back in Oxford, where I come from, that after lunch, speaking is the art of talking in someone else's sleep. But that's not my problem this afternoon, because you're such an attentive and friendly bunch. I said to someone, I don't think I've ever been to such a friendly conference before. My problem is you scheduled me when England is playing in the World Cup. So I'm tempted to speak for 5 minutes and disappear. I appeared this morning when the U.S. were two down, and while I was there, they drew. So I hope England, my absence, is doing well. Now, more serious things. Thank you, Anna. Congratulations. Obviously, Anna was the winner, but if all your students are a quarter as good as Anna, you've done an incredible job. I do speak a lot on civility, and I've written on that too. But America's facing deep problems in that area, but I think even deeper problems in terms of freedom. Let me start with a story that's well known to historians. There was a time in 1843 when a young researcher from New England was trying to meet all the veterans of the Revolutionary War. And he met an old man called Captain Levi Preston, who was 91, who had fought at both Lexington and Concord. The old boy was very bowed, 70 years older than the young researcher. And rather nervously, this researcher said, "Now, why did you go out to fight?" And the old boy was so startled, he just didn't answer. So obvious. But he straightened himself up stiffly, and the young man said, "Well, weren't you oppressed?" "Not at all," he said. "We were very free." "Well, what about the Stamp Act?" "Never paid a penny of it," he said. "How about the tea tax?" "Never drank a drop of it," he said. "The boys threw it in the harbor before we got there." "Well, surely you'd read books like Sidney and Locke and Harrington and Burke." "Never read any of them," he said. "The only books we had were the Bible and Isaac Watts' hymnal and some almanac." And he went on like this, and the young researcher was getting a little puzzled. And he asked him once more, "Why did they go out to fight?" And Captain Levi Preston answered famously, We had always been free, and we intended to be free always. And the redcoats were in our way. If you think about it, that is the most daring part, both in terms of courage and intellectual thought, that is the most daring part of the revolution. The idea that they could build a free society which could remain free forever. Now, it wasn't just that one remark. You can see that in quotations by the founders or generals like Nathaniel Greene, building a free society which could remain free. Now, Augustine said famously that you understand a people by what it loves supremely, or what he called the loved things held in common. That's what defines a people or a nation. No nation is better or worse than the loved things it holds in common. No nation is healthier or unhealthier than the condition at any time of the loved things held in common. And beyond any question to Americans, and certainly to outsiders, and I'm a foreign admirer, what America holds as a love thing in common is supremely freedom. And I want to pick up that question of the framers. Can a free society remain free forever? And how are we doing today? Set it out in a series of challenges you could think through. Maybe many of these you have thought through. And certainly things that you need to share with your children and those who graduate from your schools. Some of them are very obvious, but put them all together and see the flow of the development, and you see the challenges that America faces today. First, understand the founders' accomplishments in establishing a free society. This point is exceedingly obvious, except the part that's the least obvious is actually the most important, and the one that's most forgotten today. The founders knew that they were doing three tasks in establishing a free republic: winning freedom, ordering freedom, and the difficult one, sustaining freedom. Winning freedom, obviously, 1776, the revolution. But remember, the French did it, 1789. The Russians did it, 1917. The Chinese did it, 1949. And many have done that, throwing off the old regime. The second part, ordering freedom, is actually much harder and took longer. Ordering freedom. The moral and political arrangements through which freedom can be given order. A tempered freedom, a framed freedom. Obviously, the Constitution, 1787, 1791. And the French did not do that. The Russians, obviously, and the Chinese did not do that. And those three freedoms, revolutions, spiraled down to demonic disorder, which was worse than the tyrannies that they replaced in each case, as we know well. But the third part is the least talked about. And Americans like you, who all glory in your revolution, you hardly ever see a serious discussion today of that third part, sustaining freedom. Take Ben Franklin, famously, as he came out of the convention in Philadelphia, which you remember was secret, and Mrs. Powell asked him, what had they achieved? And his famous answer, which many of you can quote, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Now, we don't discuss that today, but the founders did. John Adams at great length, George Washington considerably, but also later presidents. You take the young Lincoln before he was president, in his famous speech at Lyceum. Here he is in his late 20s, only 3 months in Springfield. He's asked to address the young men's Lyceum. And what is the topic he chooses for the day? The perpetuation of our institutions. How are we doing 50 years on? How many young men in their late 20s would pick that topic today? How many leaders in their late 60s take that topic today? How is America sustaining freedom? Now you see the irony. Sustainability is very modern, very fashionable. Now, clearly from history, we know that no system is sustainable. This too shall pass. Nothing lasts forever. The framers are most unique when they talk about how freedom can last forever. But at the very moment, the whole world's talking about sustainability, sustainable environments, sustainable development, sustainable capitalism, sustainable ecology, this, that, and the other. How many Americans are talking about the thing that's deepest of all? Sustainable freedom. I've never heard a single one today. That's the first challenge. Second challenge, appreciate the founders' realistic concerns as to the menaces to freedom. We know the framers rightly as revolutionary. But you also know them, your teachers of history, as rooted. You could say they used history to defy history. They ransacked the classics in order to understand why nations rose and fell. And you can see their appreciation of Cicero or Polybius. Take Polybius, for example. Polybius, who was the tutor to Scipio Africanus and saw Carthage fall the final time, Polybius becomes the great historian. He was Greek, but living in Rome, and he becomes the historian who chronicles the rise and fall of political systems, and he describes them: monarchies, aristocracies, and democracies. And you remember his fundamental points, and the framers certainly did. What Polybius says, and many Americans read this and stop there, what is decisive for any political regime is its constitution. And of course, you have the oldest and greatest written constitution in the world, and so many Americans read that, and that's the end of the discussion. They go to sleep. But Polybius went on. You can have the greatest constitution in the world, those are my words, not his, but, as he points out, it rests in a bedding. A constitution, the fundamental laws, rest in a bedding of customs and traditions and moral standards and mores. And if you have a subversion, a corruption of the customs, you'll eventually have a subversion of the Constitution. And you have the same laws in name, but they're different in reality. And so for the founders, as they ransacked the classics, there were three menaces, classically, to any country sustaining its system. One, they didn't bother about. The first one, for the classics, was external menaces. You suddenly find yourself with a power greater than yourself or better armed than yourself, and you're in trouble. Like, say, the Melians facing the Athenians. For obvious reasons, the framers hardly consider that. They'd come from a small protected island, most of them, and now they lived on a huge protected continent with the world's two greatest oceans as a buffer, and the nearest enemies were mainly 3,000 miles away. So they largely ignore that one. You can see Washington dealing with it in a sentence or two and dismissing it, or the same speech of Abraham Lincoln. He talks about the possibility of a transatlantic Bonaparte putting a foot down in the cornfields of Ohio, and he dismisses it without a thought. Unthinkable. Now, of course, intercontinental ballistic missiles and the age of the internet, and you have 9/11. We have to take that a little more seriously. But what they did take seriously, we don't. And their second menace is the one I mentioned, that corruption of customs. But the third menace, in one word, is the one they reckon was almost impossible to deal with, and it's hardly mentioned today at all: time. This too shall pass. As Cicero says, things once fresh become faded. Things once revolutionary become routine. Time. Now, as you know well, when the Constitution was passed, that very same year, Edward Gibbon wrote his great classic on the decline and fall of Rome. And if you've read the classic, the last chapter says, why did Rome fall? This fall beyond belief after 800 years. America's hardly begun. After 800 years, Rome fell. And his first answer, the injuries of time. And Gibbon says he got the idea for writing the classic when he was in Rome and cattle were grazing and grass was growing where the great senators had once deliberated. The injuries of time. If you read Lincoln's speech, again, 28-year-old, how many 28-year-olds today speak about what he called the silent artilleries of time assaulting the walls that the revolution built? As a 20-something, he's aware of the decay of time. In a way, my son's that age now. It would be unthinkable of him and his friends to talk like that. The third challenge in thinking this through. Face up to the grand challenge of the paradox of freedom. Freedom always finds one great menace, freedom. And if you read history, you can see why. The paradox of freedom is kind of like a conundrum wrapped up with various levels, but the first and most obvious level is historical. Free societies are rare and fleeting. And if you look at the huge history of civilization and compress it into 1 hour of a clock, free societies only really appear in the last few minutes before midnight. They are not the human norm. But below that is a political level of the conundrum, which is much discussed by thinkers like Montesquieu and Tocqueville. And that is that to have freedom, you need both structures and spirit. So the structures are the political structures which guarantee freedom. For example, the Constitution. But the spirit is a matter of the citizens and the way they feel and think. Now, as Montesquieu points out, for the Greeks, that didn't really matter because they were a tiny democracy. So the whole of Athens came together at one time, and they were together in building the Acropolis, in going out to war, or debating in the Agora, or whatever. There was no distinction between the state and the people, but the more you have a big republic, the more it's important that the spirit of the citizens always matches the structures of the government. And as Montesquieu says, you can have structures that keep freedom, but you can lose the spirit of freedom among the citizens, which is clearly part of our challenge today. But there's a deeper level to the paradox of freedom, which is moral. Freedom requires order, which means restraint of some sort. But the only restraint appropriate to free people is self-restraint. But self-restraint is precisely what's undermined by freedom. And eventually it goes. And there are various ways, but one of them, a most obvious way, is the way that freedom becomes license and permissiveness. And you can see how we pick up that story in our own generation. The fourth challenge. Explore the framers' antidotes to the potential decline of freedom. If you ask modern Americans how will freedom last, there's almost universally, among ordinary citizens and among scholars, one answer: the Constitution. Now, that is not the framers' full answer. And that answer only came in, really, in the 1920s. In other words, it went hand in hand with a general secularization of society and a growing litigiousness in society. So notions like "my word is my bond" began to slip out. The importance of character began to disappear. And you had law filling in the place of character. And you had notions like competence filling in the place of character, and so on. But we now have the modern thing that freedom is guaranteed by the bulwark of the Constitution. Now, of course, that is half the answer. But what's the other half of the answer? The framers actually had no word for it. Tocqueville calls it the habits of the heart, which were needed along with the Constitution. My own word for it is the golden triangle of freedom. The framers didn't call it that, but that's my word reading them. But what's unambiguous is that without a single exception, all the framers insistently taught, you could almost say, preached this notion of the habits of the heart or the golden triangle of freedom. What is it? Freedom requires virtue, the first leg. Virtue requires faith of some sort, the second leg. And faith of any sort requires freedom, the third leg. And rather like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round ad infinitum. Freedom requires virtue, which requires faith, which requires freedom, which requires virtue, and so on. And you can see this clearly, for example, Franklin and both Adams and Franklin, they're teaching only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. Why? Because clearly freedom is not purely negative freedom from. Freedom is also positive freedom for, freedom to be. So the highest freedom, in Lord Moulton's famous words, freedom is obedience to the unenforceable. The highest freedom requires self-restraint, self-government, obedience to the unenforceable. Freedom requires virtue. Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom, and so on. Now, clearly, the separation of powers, checks and balances, is not original to the United States. Switzerland's had it a long, long time. Montesquieu, who puts it on the map in today's world, actually was commenting on England, not the US. That's not original. The First Amendment is the most truly original part of the American Constitution and the whole American Republic. But faith of any sort truly requires freedom. But we need to explore that in a hugely greater depth today, because clearly, it is gone. And that leads us to the fifth challenge, which is to assess the various ways in which the framers' antidotes have disappeared. You could assess this in many ways. I would just mention three things here. The first would be the privatization of religion. Now, I start there because many Christians see the whole problem as we, they. These dreadful secularists or liberals or separationists, whoever it is, who've done us in. Actually, faith started to prove inadequate long before we had much of serious opposition. Books like Whitehead's book, The Stealing of America, are actually very wrongly titled. It should be The Surrendering of America. Religion began to be privatized, in other words, theologically, it wasn't what it should have been way back in the late 19th century. And from then onwards, before there was any serious opposition, you can see the rot theologically, spiritually, in the churches, which meant that we were not who we should have been as disciples of our Lord and certainly as citizens. Any privatized faith cannot do what the framers counted on religion to do for the Republic. And we've got to really face up to the fact that, once again, the problem is not them. The far deeper problem is us. A great friend of mine whom I deeply admire, Bishop Michael Nazarelli who was the former Bishop of Rochester, often speaks in England of the double jeopardy of the church. A militant Islam on one side and a strident secularism on the other side. And he's right that those are huge challenges. But I often counter it by saying the real challenge is the triple jeopardy of the church. The problem, far deeper than secularists, far deeper than Islam, is us. Is us. We are not what we should be as disciples. And as I was saying yesterday, how can it be that we, who are a huge majority in this country, take out all the heretics and the nominals you like, we are still a huge community, and yet nationally are not having the influence we should if we were truly living as salt and light and followers of Jesus as he called us to do. The second thing which has sidelined the framers, and this is really in the mid-20th century, is what in one word is called proceduralism, often associated with John Rawls at Harvard, giving the idea that the public square is a neutral arena of competing self-interests in which faith and character and virtue are irrelevant. Now, of course, that's hardened and reinforced by what came up in the late 40s, the notion of strict separationism, very close to the French laïcité, which isn't the framers' vision. The idea that all religion is inviolably private and the public square is inviolably secular. And you can see that that's been one pole in the culture wars ever since then, but that proceduralism or strict separationism clearly wants to exclude faith from public life, which is not just a matter of religious liberty. It's highly liberal as a position. It's also undermining the system the framers set up. Since then, of course, the third factor is postmodernism. And you can see in its strongest, particularly its claim, not just that truth is relative, but that all truth is really power. The notion that comes from Nietzsche and thinkers today like Michel Foucault, obviously we dismiss all that the founding fathers said. White, wealthy, tidewater, plantation owners, all that stuff that Jefferson wrote about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, pure empty rhetoric to justify slave owning, and so on. And you can see when you put all three of those together, inadequate faith, very powerful proceduralism, and now some of the postmodernism, the public square is freezing over in many ways, and we've added to it in other ways. So we should be clear today, and here's the sixth challenge. We should be clear today about the contemporary menaces to freedom. And I would identify three. The first is a significant alienation of leaders. People I've just mentioned are obvious ones. Even Richard Rorty, a champion postmodern thinker, admits that many of his contemporaries in philosophy departments and so on, to ordinary Americans, come across as unpatriotic, and they probably are. Beyond any doubt, they're alienated. But I'm startled by the fact, I go across this country to many universities and many other ordinary situations too, how few Americans really understand how the Republic was founded and how notions like freedom were set up to see if they could last forever. Now, I'm sure you and your schools are magnificent exceptions, but including churches, the ignorance about it, to me as a foreign visitor, is absolutely appalling. And there's no question, once significant number of leaders above all, but ordinary citizens too, are either ignorant or opposed to the way a nation was set up, there's sufficient alienation for that nation to be in serious trouble. And America's in serious trouble today in terms of the way people understand how it was founded. The second contemporary menace is a breakdown in transmission. The American Republic is in the business of transmission always in two ways. One obvious way is the world you're in. The older generation's got to pass it on to the younger generation, or the younger generation won't have a clue. Now, whatever you think of the public schools, and some of you haven't said very nice things about them to me, I understand that, but remember why the public schools were started. They weren't just free universal education. They were free universal education to teach the American first things, but handed on the unum to balance the pluribus. In other words, that gave the American first things to every new generation to balance the diversity of spiritual creed and social class. Obviously, that's broken down. The second area where America's in the business of transmission is immigration. The old-timers, because there aren't very many natives, the old-timers telling the newcomers what we're about. And what's striking to me, having lived here for 25 years, or reading your history, when there was very tight immigration, say after World War I right down to 1965, there was still an insistence that those who were allowed in were taught what it was to be American. But in 1965, when the immigration laws were incredibly relaxed, there's almost no requirement of anyone knowing anything about what it is to be American. As one historian says, today it's relatively easy to become an American citizen, get your naturalization papers. It's increasingly difficult to know what it is to be American, because there aren't any first things taught. I often ask groups, what to you is the core of the unum that balances the pluribus? And hardly any groups, including churches, can give me more than one or two. Sam Huntington warned before he died that if that was so, eventually immigration would put more of its stamp on America than the revolution, simply because there's a breakdown in the double transmission that you have to have. The third contemporary menace is equally obvious, and I'll use Polybius's term, a corruption of customs. At the heart of the culture wars are a whole series of things that would have been evident to Americans on all sides up until the 1960s. What's life? What's a family? Is there such a thing as truth? Do you need character and leaders? You could be Democrat, Republican, left, right, or whatever. Now, all of those and many other things too are up for challenge all the time. But the deepest part of the culture war, often not discussed, is actually freedom. You may know that Lincoln called the Civil War a freedom war, because in many ways the South had a negative view of freedom, to use the philosopher's term, freedom from, don't tread on me and all that stuff. It was the North that had the positive view of freedom, behind abolition of human dignity and human liberation and so on. So the very liberals today who would support the North have actually abandoned positive freedom, because part of the deepest corruption of freedom today is it's all negative. And that's not only true in liberal circles, it's true in conservative circles. And conservative libertarians, don't tread on me, get the government off my, etc., etc., etc. It's all a negative view of freedom that is totally different from the framers, and more importantly, totally different from the scriptures. Last point. Tackle the challenges, and you're doing some of these magnificently, tackle the challenges of what must be done for renewal. If the Republic was set up that way, there are certain things that are very, very clearly essential to any possible renewal. One, and here you're doing a magnificent job, is the restoration of civic education. Now, that used to be called liberal education. Sadly, the L word's got a bad reputation today, and I don't mind using it. It used to mean generous or free. Never get to the place you use liberal only as a nasty word. But whatever word you use, the point behind it is what mattered. The framers understood, and anyone who thinks can understand, in a free society, everybody's born free, but not everyone's worthy of freedom. The gap between being born free and being made worthy of freedom has to be filled in by people being educated to be worthy of freedom. And that was an education in liberty, or a liberal education. Now, you wouldn't have any argument that for the last 50 years, public education is bad enough and civic education has almost disappeared. This country cannot survive until that's restored, and incidentally restored not only in Christian and classical schools, but also in the public schools. The second thing is relatively easy to see, too. We need to rebuild a civil public square. American public life is bitterly riven between supporters of a sacred public square, like the religious right, and supporters of a naked public square, as Richard Neuhaus called it, like the secular left, the strict separationists, and so on. That way is the way of disaster, of gridlock, bitterness, polarization. And remember, on this issue, unlike the one we've just looked at, civic education, we Christians, I don't mean us in the room, but all of us together, we are viewed as a key part of the problem. And if you think of it, Europe is the most secular country in the world, continent in the world, mainly as a reaction to corrupt state churches in the past. America never had that problem because of the genius of the brilliance of the First Amendment. Faith is voluntary. There's nothing established. So America traditionally, historically, has been hospitable, congenial to all religions. Take the Sonny Eisenhower period. Now, though, in the last generation, exactly following the culture wars and the rise of the religious right, you can see in the educated classes, climaxing in the new atheists, a mounting European-style vehement repudiation of religion. If this sets in concrete, and remember, they see us as the problem because of the religious right, this is not only fateful for the American Republic, it's a disaster for all of us who love Jesus, who want to enter and engage public life. We need a civil public square, a vision of public life in which everyone of every faith is free to enter and engage public life on the basis of their faith. That's freedom of conscience. But, here's the big but, within an agreed framework of the rights, responsibilities, and respect that are not only ours, but everyone else's too. So a right for a Christian is a right for an atheist and a Jew and a Mormon and a Muslim and a Scientologist or whomever. A right for one is a right for another, and a responsibility for both. And that, of course, has implications. If we want to have a way in public life, we've got to persuade and not coerce, and so on. And unless America rebuilds a civil public square, once implicit, now bitterly collapsed, this republic again will be in deep trouble. The third necessary essential for renewal, and this one's harder to say in a few words, is the reordering of the spheres. Christians have actually thought about this for a long time, thanks to our Dutch friends like Abraham Kuyper. Now many in the secular world are picking this up. The integration of society has broken down. And we're more and more conscious in a globalized world of these huge autonomous spheres of politics and government or economics or whatever it is. all going their own ways, and in many ways, each of them, the more powerful they are, colonizing other spheres. So economics, everything is up for buying and selling. Politics now wants to regulate everything in every area. What you'd see as you look at America is that the spheres of American society are disordered. They're quite literally deranged. And in many of these spheres, you have individuals with their individual goals making the most of their spheres on Wall Street, for example, or in politics, for example. Whereas the spheres should not only serve the interests of individuals, but should also serve the interests of the common good. So they all work for the Republican common good with a small r, and not just for the individuals in the various spheres. Now, there's no way to legislate that. And if it goes on like it is now, once more, this will be a country of injustice and lack of freedom. And probably our greatest contribution here is Christians going into all these spheres with a deep sense of calling. And as we were thinking yesterday, calling, of course, is not just I, myself, and me. But as each of us serves God's purposes as we enter law or business or politics or whatever it is, we serve God's purposes far bigger than our own small purposes, but we also serve the interests of the common good. And Christians in any sphere today should be people who are articulating and arguing not just for their own sectional or personal interests, but for the interests of the common good, and of course, for the poor and the oppressed who will be overlooked. Now let me draw this together. People often think that if you give a realistic analysis, someone asked me this a couple of days ago, you must be a pessimist. No. I always reject, as I said yesterday, the labels optimist or pessimistic. Those are purely psychological. They depend on circumstances. Christians, I trust, we should be as realistic as we can, but knowing the Lord, there is always hope. Always hope. Now, how do we think about hope in this situation? You remember, I mentioned Lincoln when he was 28. You remember his famous speech in Wisconsin, talking about the Oriental monarch who sent out his wise men to look for a truth which would be true in all times and places, and they came back with a famous answer. Come on, you classical people. This too shall pass. And Lincoln says, but let us yet hope that this is not quite true of us, he's saying. And he goes on to say, we've got to cultivate this incredible environment in which America's living, and we've got to cultivate the intellectual and moral resources within us. Let us hope that it's not quite true. Can we do better than that? Because if you look at history, that won't give you terribly much hope. I think you can. I'm struck by the framers' understanding, at least some of them, of the parallels between Jews, Puritans, and themselves. Think of this one. There were three. The third one of which is incredibly interesting. The first and obvious parallel is that what for the Jews was Exodus, for the Puritans, spiritually, was conversion. And for the framers, politically and secularly, they're not exact parallels, was what? Revolution. In other words, that liberating experience, Exodus, conversion, 1776, the liberating experience that set a people free. Their second parallel, what for the Jews was covenant, for the Puritans was also covenant, and for the framers was what? Constitution, thank you. Because the American Constitution is a nationalized, secularized form of government growing out of the Reformation. But here's the interesting one. What for the Jews, in one word, was return. Have you ever followed that word in the Old Testament? We Christians don't make enough of it. Return. The people of God, however dark, however distant, if they return to God, the Lord returns to them. That word return is incredibly powerful in ways we don't pick up today. For the Puritans was what? Revival. But what's interesting to me, the framers knew that they needed an equivalent. George Mason, who was actually on the vestry of Falls Church, where I worship today, along with George Washington, also on the vestry, George Mason talked about the need for a frequent recurrence to fundamental first principles. Thomas Jefferson, some of you from Virginia, our great Mr. Jay, Thomas Jefferson, far more liberal, he spoke of the need for a revolution every 20 years. You always have to go back. Have you ever thought that the two greatest movements of ideas in our Western history were the Renaissance and the Reformation? Both of them were movements of return. And if you think at a far more serious level, in contrast to all our trendy, relevance-seeking young Christians today, the church always goes forward best by going back first. That's what we call Reformation. That's what Reformation and revival are. And America is the same. A frequent recurrence to fundamental first principles. A revolution in every generation, because every new generation, as Tocqueville said, is a new people. So things are dark today. We are in very, very serious times for the Western world, for the American Republic, and for the Church of Jesus Christ in America. But I'm not the slightest bit pessimistic. There is always hope, but we've got to look in the right direction. Finish with a thought from Tocqueville. As you know, Tocqueville's great book, Democracy in America, is probably the greatest book still on the United States. Certainly the greatest by an outsider. Tocqueville was an admirer of this country, but you know, he didn't write it for you. He wrote it for his fellow Frenchmen. And he'd hoped they'd understand the American Revolution better in order to steer their own better. But at the end of his life, he was a very disappointed lover in the French Revolution. But one of the last things he wrote was this. He just wrote down this wonderful little line. In a revolution, as in a novel, the hardest part to invent is the end. Your framers, founders, wrote a brilliant, daring first chapter. God knows they made mistakes and they had blind spots. Above all, their treatment of African Americans and of women. But they wrote a brilliant, stirring first chapter. And many stirring chapters have been written since then. Think of The Greatest Generation. But the chapter the next generation writes will probably be the one that is decisive for the endurance of this country. And you have the privilege of educating many of the best of them. God be with you. Thank you. We have just a few minutes, and today we have a roving mic. So catch Patch's eye.
I've always been interested in Abraham Kuyper in the Netherlands, and the more I hear about Kuyper, the more impressed I am with him. What would you say would be some lessons that could be learned from the history of the Netherlands since Kuyper, in your opinion?
Obviously, the greatness of Kuyper was the lordship of Christ over the whole of life and his notion of spheres. That was the greatness. The unfortunate effect, though, while much of that was terrific, was that many of the Dutch Christians accepted what they called in Holland the pillarization of society. So you have Catholic spheres, Protestant spheres, humanist, secularist spheres, and so on. So here's this Catholic pillar, and you have Catholic primary schools, Catholic secondary schools, the free university, and so on. And the same with others, Protestants and secularists. Well, sadly, that led to a pillarization of society and the creation of subcultures. And then, of course, when they lost that transforming, revolutionary, outgoing spirit, they were secularized too. So today, much of the Free University of Amsterdam is about as secular as any other European university. And we've always got to be aware of the ironies of history. We too have fallen. So if you look at the Reformation today, the Reformation, I'm saying this too fast, not looking at the details, the Reformation produced the most secular societies history has ever seen. Or in the name of reforming the church, we've produced some of the most heretical, apostate versions of the church that's ever seen. Take the American Episcopal Church. I often tell the story. I was at dinner with a Catholic cardinal, and we were talking about religious liberty. It was a wonderful evening, and six of us. And as we were standing up to leave, he turned to me and said, "Tell me about the crisis in the Episcopal Church." And I sort of groaned. You know, it's what we call a soup question in our family, not a dessert question. So to sort of fob him off, I said, "Well, Monsignor," or whatever his title was, "you've had your Borgia popes," that's all I said. And he suddenly got dead serious. He said, "Yes, we did. And Alexander VI was probably the most evil leader the church has ever had. As you know, he committed incest, murder, he had children by his own daughter. You name it, he did it all. But," the cardinal said, "none of the Borgia popes denied a single article of the Apostles' Creed. And your Episcopal leaders deny almost all of them and stay on as Christian leaders. That's the disgrace." Touche. It's the Reformation parts of the church today where you have the most profound rottenness. That's the sad thing.
Magnificent talk, thank you.
Sorry?
Magnificent talk, thank you. I amened just about all of it. I've got a yeah but question to a point right near the end. It had,
I thought we were always in a debate in a pub, Douglas.
Yeah, yeah. That's just the tip of the iceberg. When you were talking about the necessity of civility in the public square, I want to ask a question about that and could juxtapose that with the need for revolution from time to time to clean things up. With Christians who are accused of being part of the religious right, and I can be accused of being part of the rabid religious right, and I'm holding back, right? So when it doesn't take very much at all to get pigeonholed that way. When we go into the public square to debate or discuss, we can all say amen to the need for civility, but is not civility in the public square a function of a religious commitment, an overarching religious commitment that dictates what public squares ought to look like? Can we be neutral about that? Where do we get the values for a civil public square? Shouldn't Christians get that from the Lordship of Christ? And how can we balance that with the need for getting in there every 20 years and making a mess, being willing to let people call us all kinds of things? Are all the accusations that are made against conservative Christians accurate?
No, clearly not. I have never heard anyone put you in the bad guys in that sort of area. No, certainly I wasn't thinking of that. But on to the depth of your question. Civility is a classical virtue that is a means for dealing with a deep challenge of a public square, which is how do you live with people very different from yourself? How do we live with our deepest differences, most of which are religious? In other words, it's not per se a Christian virtue. I think we have Christian virtues that undergird civility. Like, for example, love your enemy, or speaking the truth with love, our Lord being full of truth and grace, grace and truth. So I think we have Christian ideals and standards and commandments that allow us virtues that undergird the classical notion. The trouble is, civility has become, in the modern notion, a form of niceness, etiquette, tea party manners, that is an alternative to nastiness, but is very, very weak. And we've lost the classical virtue, but my concern is the Christian loss. So, for example, you take the post-election attacks on Obama going around by email. I can think of, I get a flood of these, and I'm sure they don't all originate there, but mine are all sent from Texas. I'm sure they don't all originate there, I'm quick to say. But there's one I've had four times on why I'm a Muslim. The Bible would call that video false witness. They have scissors and pasted things he said, cut out things he truly said, at it is totally false. They're passing this round to inflame people. Or you see stuff about, you know, the demon, any demonizing or stereotyping is not speaking the truth in love. And you compare the teaching of Jesus or, say, the example of, say, William Wilberforce, probably the most vilified man in the world in the late 18th century, but he was so humble and gracious, also funny. He went out of his way to love his enemies, although he was passionate against slavery. One time when one of his worst enemies died, he saw to it the man's widow had a pension. And he was known for his loving treatment of those who hated him. If we were known for that, we'd be different. So you're absolutely right. Civility per se is not a Christian virtue, but we have Christian reasons that are even stronger that should undergird it. And even as a classical virtue, it's an important one. Now, you wanted to come back on something else.
So you would describe that as being a civil, Wilberforce was a civil revolutionary.
Absolutely.
That's how you describe it.
Yeah. Would you have differences with that?
No.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One more, Patch?
One more. If there is one more.
Everyone's silent today. Oh, no, no.
Make it. I had a lady I saw come around first.
Mr. Guinness, I had a question about one of your statements that a right for a Christian is a right for another religion. And I understand the gist of what you're saying. My question has to do with, would this extend even to atheism? For example, if marriage is a right for a Christian, do we extend that to marriage's right for a God-hating homosexual, for example, or even a professing God-loving homosexual? So I was just curious how far that goes.
If you understand the history of freedom of conscience, which doesn't come out of the Enlightenment first, but comes out of the Reformation, freedom of conscience and religious liberty were without limit. And you can go back to someone like, say, Roger Williams in the 1640s, and he talks about freedom of conscience for those he calls Mohammedans and infidels, what we call today Muslims and atheists. And you can see that in Isaac Bacchus, you can see it in all the early Christian supporters of this notion, that it is for everyone. Now, they had theological arguments too. For example, the notion of hell. That God allows us to choose hell, an eternity apart from him, rather than, in Roger Williams' terms, raping our conscience. So it was without limit. Now, as you see the discussion come down to the birth of the American Republic, clearly that has implications. Everyone has a right to hold what they believe based on dictates of conscience. Reads Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance, which picks this up. But there's obviously two qualifications. One is freedom of conscience is absolute in beliefs It's not absolute in behavior, because behavior begins to touch other people, other things. So, for example, someone who believes in witchcraft can believe whatever vile things they believe, but they can't sacrifice cats, and they certainly can't sacrifice humans, as they've tried to do, say, in Britain, bringing in African witchcraft. The second qualification is that while everyone has the right to freedom of conscience, absolutely, it is dangerous if the wrong ideas prevail in society. And this touches what you're thinking of. So if you read John Adams' discussion of the discourses of Davila, how you pronounce that word, he talks about what we call atheist views, people who see the universe has no father, as he says, and humans are no different from animals. And he says, if we get to such a position, which we've got to with Peter Singer in Princeton and many other people today, we're in a very disconsolate position. In other words, he's assuming that if you have a civil public square, which is free for everyone to enter and engage, those who do hold high views of freedom and justice and humanity and dignity and so on will enter that public square and be publicly vociferous and persuasive in their arguments. And if the day comes they aren't, then we're in trouble. And Burke picks this up. You know, freedom's in trouble, and evil flourishes when good people do nothing. In other words, the American system is a gamble. And the way I put it is this: constitutionally, there's no limit to what anyone in America can believe. I mean, I think some forms of belief are vile. I think some are just crazy. Take, say, dear old Tom Cruise in Scientology. But constitutionally, he has a right to believe that before the law and before God. And he's responsible finally to God. But culturally, not every belief is good. And there are beliefs that are possible that would bring the whole system down. And we've got to argue against those. And how do you bridge that gap between what's constitutionally permissible and culturally disastrous? You build it, as Jefferson says, by tough, robust debate. And if the day comes you don't have enough citizens who know what it is to argue for things that are just and human and free and so on, then the republic's in trouble. See, you can cave in one of two ways: either having some illiberal views taking over, unjust views taking over, or everyone being so tolerant of everything they don't care about anything, and you just slump into an indifference where nobody bothers, and you go into the sump. But I think it's part of the gamble, or put it in the framers' terms, the open-endedness of the great experiment. Thank you.